This is Margaret Pauline Stinson, recording for the Lansing unit of the Women's Overseas Service League. Margaret lives at 207 47th Avenue Drive West, Bradenton, Florida, 33507. She may be located at this address. The date today is October 2nd, 1984. Go ahead, Margaret. Where did you spend your time overseas?
I spent my time overseas in Alaska. My husband and I had wanted to do something different. We were both teachers, and we applied and finally got an appointment to Alaska in 1933, and the appointment was as teachers in Indian Service, the Alaskan Native Service Department of the Department of Interior, and we went to Alaska, and that's where we taught in the federal government service for 15 years, and then the 1 year of our service in federal government was on the Navajo Indian Reservation, so I always say that I had 16 years of federal service.
Are you on a federal retirement system?
No, I am not, because 16 years is not too much for a pension, and so when I came back to Michigan and brought all of my teaching credits, it was better for me to be retired with a Michigan Retired Teachers Association, rather than the federal government.
Couldn't you have had both?
No, you may not have both.
Oh, I didn't know. Well, I'm glad to hear that.
You may not, at least that's what they told me down at the department here, the Michigan Retired Teachers Department in Lansing. Mm-hmm. So they did the thing that they did. They took my years of service in the federal government, and because I went to Alaska so long ago and the salary was so small. And of course, when I came back into Michigan, then I had to pay back into their retirement system. And it worked out better for me to use those years than some of my other teaching years.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I'm retired. I have a Michigan teacher's retirement pension.
You decided to go to Alaska then with your husband, is that right?
Yes, we both went. Mm-hmm, we went.
What did he do?
He was a teacher.
Oh, he was a teacher.
He was a teacher. And we went, our first station was at a little Eskimo village called Shishmaref. And Shishmaref is on an island north of Wales in the Arctic Ocean, on the Arctic Ocean coast. And we were there our first 4 years. That was from 1933 to 1937.
Roughly, how far is Shishmaref from Anchorage? Which all of us
know
about.
It's a long way from Anchorage, mm-hmm. Yes. It's more,
500, 600 miles?
Oh dear, I don't know in mileage. Mm-hmm. I'm going to guess it's farther than that.
Okay.
But it's better to try to locate Shishmaref from Nome. Nome and Shishmaref are on the Seward Peninsula, and if you know where the straits are between the United States and Russia, then mm-hmm. we were 75 miles along the coast north of that.
Ooh.
So we were just 15 miles south of the Arctic Circle when we were at Shishmaref. Mm.
Goodness, then you were able to see perpetual days in the summertime, weren't you?
Yes, yes, uh-huh. And it isn't so difficult to adjust yourself to perpetual days because it's a gradual thing.
Mm-hmm.
As you get you can recognize the difference in daylight as the daylight lengthens. 15 minutes a day of daylight on both ends of the day adds up pretty fast.
It sure does.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I have been within the Arctic Circle in Norway.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. So you know what that's like a little bit.
Right.
Well, we were there 4 years, and then the federal government had decided that they would, all of their teachers had to have a bachelor's, a degree, and I did not have my degree. I needed an extra year of college, so we took a year's leave of absence and came to Michigan, back to Michigan, and we went to the University of Michigan for a year. And my husband got his master's degree that year at University of Michigan. And then when I finished that year, I still needed 6 hours of credit to graduate. So I took all my credits back to Western, and I have my Bachelor of Arts degree from Western Michigan University.
Mm-hmm. Did you go back to Alaska?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Then we went back, and when we went back that year, in 1938, Mr. Stinson took a job with the reindeer service, and we lived in Nome that year.
With the reindeer, did you say?
With the reindeer service, the U.S. government reindeer service.
You went to Nome.
We were in Nome, and I taught in the Alaska Native Service School in Nome, and he was in the reindeer service. But then the government moved us the next year, 1939, to Kotzebue. And we were in Kotzebue when the Japanese invaded Alaska.
What islands had the Japanese taken? Do you remember?
Well, I remember that they had taken the island of Attu, and also in this area of Unimak Pass.
Unimak,
the island of Unimak, and the Unimak Pass part, Dutch Harbor, in the area of Dutch Harbor. But of course, we were up in Kotzebue, and we were there for in Kotzebue at the time that would be December 1941. Isn't
December
that right?
That's when Pearl Harbor was
yes.
taken.
Yes, okay, that's it.
Mm-hmm. Weren't you afraid?
Well, I was a long way from the Aleutian Islands, because I should tell you that we had in our home just a battery radio, and it was a good radio, but we were a long ways away from any place where we could get extra batteries, so we were always very careful about not turning on the radio for anything but news. And so that would be the probably the not the very day, but it would be the morning that we could have heard about it, or we might have been able to hear about the attack on the Aleutians by the Japanese, if we had the radio on all constantly. But we didn't, because we had to save the battery
mm-hmm.
of the radio. So Mr. Stinson was one of these people who loved to sleep on Saturday morning, and he was upstairs in our home sleeping, and I got up that morning and I was finishing my Christmas cards, because I still didn't have all of my Christmas letters and my Christmas cards done. And when he got up, he turned on the radio, and I can still remember how disgusted he was with me, because I had not turned on the radio and I had missed all of this news of the Japanese attack. But of course, he could have been out of bed earlier too and listened to it. But that was how we happened to hear about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then that day, all of the government people in Kotzebue met. And I think that it would be better for me now to stop and tell about a little bit about Kotzebue.
Go ahead.
Because in Kotzebue we had a government school, Alaska Native Service School for the Eskimos. And that school was from of kindergarten through the 8th grades. And then if any of the children after they finished 8th grade wanted to go on to school, they went to boarding schools either in Alaska or down in the lower states. But in Kotzebue we had the government school, then we had a government hospital with doctors and nurses, we had a Signal Corps, and at that time at the Signal Corps there were two men, and they were married and their wives lived there. We had a commissioner, United States commissioner. We had a United States post office. And all of these government organizations were, at that time, they were run by white people. We did not have Native people in those days in those positions. But besides that, in Kotzebue, we had three large, big trading company stores, huge, big companies. And they did all of the business and the trading. And then besides that, we had an airplane company that was a small airplane company that was located in Kotzebue. That gives you an idea that we had quite a few people there who were government people. So that
by quite a few, do you mean 50 or do you mean 100?
Around 50 people. Mm-hmm. And they were all in some way, except the store people, were connected with different departments of the government.
Mm-hmm.
So on the day of Pearl Harbor Day, they all met, plus the Native people who were on the Native Council, and they made a decision that they would have to do something to guard or to protect Kotzebue, and they had Signal Corps men sort of took charge because they felt that they were the closest to the army, the military of mm-hmm. any of us. So they took charge. And right away at this meeting, they decided that they would have to organize all of the men in town. That would include all of the Eskimo men as well as the government men and the white men. And they made a list of everybody, and then they assigned different parts of the little village that they were to guard. And the thing that was really interesting was that my husband Thor was to guard the schoolhouse. And he had several guns, but he carried his 30-06 that night, and he walked all the way around. He did guard duty all around the schoolhouse, and I was the one that was on the inside being guarded. And then they had
one man guarding a schoolhouse.
One man was guarding, and I was inside.
With a little communication, a radio, as batteries were limited. How did you get supplies there, by the way?
To Kotzebue.
But the battery, how often did you get them?
We got, our supplies came in those days by freighter.
And how often?
They came We always got at least one big freighter from Seattle, where the Alaska Steamship Company came at least once a year. And once a year. And then we had a mail boat that came from Nome at least twice a month during the summertime. And then we had the government boat came only once from Seattle into Kotzebue. And now Kotzebue is in on Kotzebue, up the Kotzebue Sound. And the ship, that's shallow, so the big ships are not able to come into Kotzebue. They have to be lightered. Everything had to be lightered from the big ship, and the big freighter lay off shore from Kotzebue at least 15 miles. Mm-hmm. And everything came by boat in those days, except we had airplanes, and our airplanes could bring us things from Fairbanks.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll go back to this business of how the men had organized. Well, they guarded the Signal Corps buildings, they guarded the hospital, they guarded the commissioner's home and little office and the post office. And then, now this was in deep winter, and so the thing,
cool.
Yes, and we had lots of snow and big snowbanks. So the thing that they did down at the Signal Corps, I think that the Signal Corps people, because they had ways of hearing what was going on, and we didn't, that they were more frightened than we were, because I think that we knew that they could come in by airplane, but at that time of the year they couldn't have possibly gotten in by ship to us. And but the thing that they did at the Signal Corps, they had paths that they had cut out of the snow, and they let everybody know that if anybody came at and approached the building and didn't stay on the path, that they'd shoot them.
Mm-hmm.
So when you had to take a telegram down to have it sent out by the Signal Corps people, you were mighty careful where you walked and let them know that you were coming, so they didn't start shooting you. Well, my husband and the doctor had talked it over, and they had said that they would have to have another meeting, because the Eskimo men would not be able to spend the amount of time guarding these buildings that the committee had decided that they would have to do, because Eskimo people do not, they have to go out and with their dog sleds, and in those days it was dog sled, not these snowmobiles.
Mm-hmm.
I understand now they use snowmobiles, but in those days it was dog sleds.
How many dogs to a sled? I'm often wondering.
Anywhere from seven, they're uneven numbers, seven to 15, depending on where they were going, what condition the weather was in, how far the trip was going to be, who was going with them, how big the load would be, all depended. They didn't have to take it the same number every time. But I've seen...
They're nice dogs, too. I had a sled dog.
Uh-huh. So they decided that the men couldn't take that much time out of their daily, weekly chores that they had to do, because they had to go after fuel, They had to go after wood. They had to go after dog food. They had to go and take care of their traps, their trap line. And they had to fish, do ice fishing. They had to go to wherever they had their caches with their food. And so finally, they had another meeting. And at the next meeting, they finally had to convince the Signal Corps men, those two Signal Corps men, that it was impossible for them to do it because they weren't prepared. And it might be interesting to know that actually Eskimo people did not bring in a tremendous amount of supplies into a village for and have it there, right in the village for the winter. Because in their culture says that if you have a supply and at this moment you're not needing it and using it, then you sort of have to let me borrow it. And I will eventually pay it back. But my husband used to talk to the Eskimo men when he was out at corralling and when he was out at camps with them. And he'd say to them, I can't understand why you don't bring in a tremendous amount of wood in the boat in the summertime and have it. And they'd say, well, if I did that, I wouldn't have enough to last me the winter, because it's our way that if you ask me for it and I have it, I must give it to you. And I would be giving away my winter supply, and I can't do that. Mm-hmm. So we white people, we thought, well, my goodness, it would be so much simpler. But we didn't understand some of their problems that they had. Now, another thing that I remember about that particular time, that right, those few weeks right after Pearl Harbor, one day a native man came, an Eskimo came to Mr. Stenson. He said, may I borrow your 30-06? And Thor said, what do you need to do? And this Eskimo was quite excited at the moment, and he said, well, he said, my gun isn't very good. And he said, we have seen somebody walking down by the inlet, and we're sure that it's somebody that's a stranger that has come. They didn't know whether it was a Japanese or who it was, but he was frightened. And so Thor said, yes, you take the gun, but you better be sure that it isn't somebody that, before you shoot, be sure you know who it is. And pretty soon the native came back and he said it was the priest. The priest had on a long black overcoat, and they'd never seen him with that. And he was walking along the inlet that's behind on the shore behind the village. But
how did you get those paths cleared out? Did you shovel them by hand?
They shoveled.
Mm-hmm. By hand.
By hand. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We didn't have snow blowers in those days at all. No.
Well, that would be a lot of shoveling. How
yes.
deep were they? I would imagine.
Oh, they were probably as high as my hips are.
Oh, I see.
They weren't where the paths were. It would depend on where the snowbanks were.
Right.
Now, I think we always think of Alaska as having lots of snow.
Mm-hmm.
And in northern Alaska, we don't have that much snow, but it looks as if we do because of the snowbanks.
Mm-hmm.
The wind blows the snow, and anything that it hits, any obstruction, then it begins to pile up beside that. But We had snowbanks clear up to our second story windows in our buildings, but I could see the grass sticking out on the over on the runway of for the airplanes or out on the meadow. So it wasn't that we had, you know, lots of deep snow all over. It was, it blew into the village and blew a huge big.
I know my children in school in science always, when I said it doesn't snow when it gets real cold. And the children wondered how we had so much snow in Alaska if it didn't snow when it was, you know, way below zero. And I explained to them that there was drifting, and then there were periods of time when it did snow, when the temperatures would be hovering the freezing point.
We had a huge, every year we had a huge snowbank between the hospital and the schoolhouse in Kotzebue, and that's where we had our bomb shelter. The men had dug a, actually they had dug a tunnel right so we didn't have to go over the snowbank to get to the hospital. And then they had enlarged that tunnel so that it became the bomb shelter, and we had drills with the school children where we went out and had a the bell would be rung, and all of the children went out of the schoolhouse and into the bomb shelter, and then the all clear sign would clear and give us this, they'd ring the bell, I suppose that was it. I can't remember how they did it, but then we'd all go back into the schoolhouse. So we did have, we had bomb shelter drills, then they organized the Alaska, let me think now what it's called. Alaska Native, not Signal Corps, but Guard. Yeah, National Guard, that's it.
Okay.
The Alaska Native National Guard. And Mr. Stinson was one of the officers in the Alaska Native National Guard. And a great many of the boys, they registered for the draft, and a great many of the Eskimo boys went into the Army. And I always think it's rather interesting that they sent the Alaskan boys to Alabama and North Carolina, South Carolina, Louisiana, and then the army units that came up to Alaska came from the deep south too, so they sent our boys out and they sent other southern boys in. Now there were, as far as shipping was concerned, there were no ships that came into the Arctic because at that time of the year, No ships came through the
Bering Straits.
The Bering Straits until summertime the next summer.
What did you eat up there?
Well, in Kotzebue, we ate food, canned food, a lot. In Kotzebue, you remember I told you we had three big trading posts, and those trading posts had all kinds of. Food.
By big, do you mean?
Let me think.
Not as big as a Kroger store or Meijer store here.
the depot, the Michigan Central Depot downtown.
Yes.
As big as that.
Oh, I see. And you had lots of food there.
And we had lots of food.
You didn't have to worry about eating then.
No.
Except the monotony of it.
Yeah. Now, in those days, when we lived there in Kotzebue, from 19, I'd like to back up a little bit because out here where Shishmaref was, our first station on Seward Peninsula, there were several reindeer herds, and We had a very excellent man who was a rancher from Montana, I believe, and he told the government, he was government man, and he had charge of this, this area, and he said that if they did not kill off more, or what should I call that, lessen their herds, mm-hmm. that they wouldn't have any reindeer in a few years.
Right, they die in the winter.
No, yes.
Food supply.
It was, there was plenty of food supply for summer grazing,
mm-hmm.
but reindeer eat reindeer moss,
mm-hmm.
and in the wintertime, and when they when they've eaten up and have no more reindeer moss, then they either migrate or they die.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went in 1933 to Shishmaref,
mm-hmm.
plenty of reindeer. By the time we got up to Kotzebue in 1939, the herds had been depleted till there were hardly any herds left. Now the Nervik village had a good herd. Kivalina had still had a herd. So you're asking what we ate. We always had reindeer
meat.
All reindeer meat all the time.
Taste. I ate it.
Reindeer
it
meat.
The time I had it.
That's right. Because the fat,
mm-hmm.
the fat on a reindeer lays just under the skin,
mm-hmm.
and it isn't.
Marbled.
It isn't marbled like beef is.
Mm-hmm.
You have to know how to cook, and you have to add spices, and you have to add some extra fat, because as a rule, it is dry. It is drier than most meat, but it tastes like Michigan deer.
Yes, I would say.
Yeah,
so
it
too.
Does.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Did you have milk of any sort up there?
No, we had canned milk.
Yeah, but you didn't have.
But we had no cows.
No cows up there.
No, mm-hmm. no cows. Mm-hmm.
Were there any babies
they
up there? Were there?
What?
There were any babies up there? Were there?
Baby what?
Baby children.
Oh yes.
They would need milk, but they would have to nurse their mother.
They, that's
they could
right.
have the canned
milk. Oh, I see
mm-hmm.
what you mean. Yes,
mm-hmm.
but there were cows in Nome.
Oh, I see. Then you could have gotten some.
Yes, in Nome uh-huh. there were cows,
mm-hmm.
so you could buy milk. But after you live in Alaska for a while, you get so that you like canned milk.
Mm-hmm.
And wherever the native people could afford to buy canned milk, they bought it,
mm-hmm.
and especially in Kotzebue, because Kotzebue was more of a place where people had opportunities to work and to make money.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have to do it all by the fishing and hunting.
Did you get out of Kotzebue very often?
Out of there?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the first...
Did you travel any?
Yes. The first summer that we lived in Kotzebue, we went on a trip up the Kobuk River to Shungnak, and I stayed with the government teacher at Shungnak, and Mr. Stenson went on with two other men, and he went on up into the Colville River on a hunting trip, a sheep hunting trip.
Mm-hmm.
He was hunting for Dall sheep, and then. The other summer that we were there, full summer we were in Kotzebue, we had a nursery school, or a preschool, a summer school. We had that every summer that we were in Alaska. We had teaching in the Navy Service. We always had summer schools, and we did other things, fun things, rather than the regular school curriculum.
How many children did you have in school up there?
Well, in Kotzebue, we must have had around approximately 90 to 100 children. And there, we did have an extra teacher.
You had three teachers?
We had three teachers. One time, One year we had four teachers, and all Mr. Stenson did was to be the principal, and then the other three. Because there's a tremendous amount of work in Kotzebue to be done, since it was the hub of all of the business of the upriver stations. There was Nurvik, Selawik, Kivalina, Kiana, Shungnak. Did I say Nurvik? And all those stations came downriver to, in the summertime, there were approximately 1,500 people in Kotzebue in the summertime.
You said there was a lot of work up there. What do you mean by a lot of work?
Well, just the kind of, well, for instance, if supplies came in, they came into our warehouse, all of those supplies had to be redistributed and go upriver by riverboat.
Oh.
And that kind of business.
You mentioned being in the second story. You lived in a house, a wooden frame house or a brick house? What
yes,
kind of a house?
Lived in a great big barn of a building, and we had one end of it was our house, and the other end of it was downstairs was the school room for the upper grades, and then upstairs was my school room for the elementary, I mean the lower ones, lower
mm-hmm.
grades.
Oh,
and I had kindergarten, first, second,
mm-hmm.
and I think I usually had the third grade and the other teacher in another building,
mm-hmm.
had the fourth, fifth, and sixth, and then we'd have seventh and eighth. It depended how the number of children per grade worked out. We kind of fixed it so that around 30 children in a room.
Did you have help or did you have to do all your work yourself in your home?
I had a maid.
You had a maid?
Yes.
She made your bed and did some cooking for you?
In Kotzebue, I had to have a maid because my government home was the only place for travelers, for the government people that came back and forth. They, supervisors and people from the Juneau office and people from Washington. And even I have had the governor of Alaska at my home in Kotzebue.
So you had to entertain them too, in addition to being a teacher?
Yes.
You had
mm-hmm.
to act as an official
yes.
host.
And I had to have help there. But, I should have had help every place wherever I lived, but I didn't. When I lived at Shishmaref, I didn't have help.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have maid service.
Did your experience take you out of Alaska?
To go to something outside of Alaska?
Yeah, did you ever go to any other country?
Well, I've been outside the United States, but not for any
not
reason.
Not for government service?
No, not for government
mm-hmm.
service, no. The only other government service that I did outside of Alaska was the year that we lived on the Navajo Indian Reservation.
Well, that was in
that was in
Arizona.
Mm-hmm. But that was in 1951.
Then you were in Alaska for a total of how many years?
Well, we went there in 1933.
Mm-hmm.
And we took a year's leave of absence to go to the university.
Right.
And then another time we took a year's leave of absence and went to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And so the years that we were in Alaska added up to 19 years.
19 years.
Wait a minute. I'm wrong. 18 years.
18.
Because the thing that we did, when we went to Europe in 1950 for our year's leave of absence, then when we came back, instead of going back to Alaska, we went to the Navajo.
Mm-hmm.
Then from the Navajo, then we did go back to Alaska, but when we went back, we didn't go into the government service. We went and taught in the territorial service. Because Alaska was a territory all of the time that I ever lived there.
See, you never lived there.
I never have lived there since it was a state.
How did you take the end of the war in Alaska?
Well, this is what happened. I never believed that a woman should work as long as her husband had a job. I thought there were other things that were important for a woman to do. But when I went to Alaska, I started working, and I continued to work from then on. But I had sort of promised or said that, all right, if I work, then we'll save what I make and we'll use that for travel and education. And so we had a little plan in our mind when we went that we would stay in Alaska and work for 4 years, then we'd go out for 4 years on a trip, then we'd go back in for 4 years. And that worked fine until the war came along. And when we were supposed to have our year off in 1942, we wrote to the office in Juneau and asked them if we could have a year's leave of absence, and told them what we wanted to do, that we wanted to go to Europe. And the office wrote back and wanted to know if we didn't know that there was a war on and nobody was taking vacations. And we said, well, then we wrote back and we said, all right, if you don't want us to take our year's leave of absence, then we will be glad to take a station in southeastern Alaska. So they transferred us from Kotzebue to southeastern Alaska to a school at Klawok. And actually we were then in Klawok during the rest of the war years. And that's down in southeastern Alaska. Just west of Ketchikan,
uh-huh.
And on Prince of Wales Island.
And that's south of Juneau. Uh-huh.
Yes. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And so we were there during the rest of the war. And the Japanese had even invaded some of this area.
By invaded, you mean they had taken...
They had come coast? Ashore. Mm-hmm. They had come ashore and had...
Taking the buildings the Americans had?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Now, when they attacked out here in the Aleutians, they killed the school teacher at Attu.
I see.
And they took his wife captured. They captured her, took her captive. Mm-hmm. And she was interned in Japan for the rest of the war. And then she was returned after the war. So they actually had a battle here.
When I was in Japan, someone in Hokkaido told me that they believed that Japan had invaded half of the United States. Mm-hmm. Well, if one considers these limited islands, I probably shouldn't say limited, but in size and so forth, it actually does cover half of the United States. So mm-hmm. maybe there was a bit of truth in that.
Well, they...
A mite of truth,
uh-huh,
let's say.
Uh-huh. They did have some skirmishes,
mm-hmm,
in this area, but in the Aleutian area, that's where the attack really took place, as far as Alaska.
I wrote to someone in ADAC at that time.
Yes, ADAC's
I remember reading the article,
uh-huh,
in Reader's Digest.
Uh-huh.
I was,
uh-huh,
told to read it.
Yes, uh-huh. And all during the war, this area along the Aleutians was protected. And
I stopped on ADAC two one,
uh-huh,
time when we came back from Japan.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. I had forgotten about ADAC. But actually, the thing that I think that down in Klawok, the thing that I remember the most about the war period was that our fresh food was limited. The Coast Guard boats used to be in there. They didn't They didn't dock so much at Klawock, but at Craig. They were stationed at mm-hmm. Craig. And all of our fresh foods and meats and things like that went to the Coast Guard rather than mm-hmm. to be available for us. Mm-hmm. So we ate a lot of canned meat. And down in Klawock, the farmer had cows. And we had meat and milk. Regularly, mm-hmm. and lots of fish, lots of fish. Wherever we lived in Alaska, we had a lot of fish.
And did you find any adjustment when you came back to the lower 48?
No. The only adjustment I really ever had to make was driving a car.
Oh,
because
you had to
I lived without a car.
It seemed kind of good to get off those big bulky clothes you had to wear up there.
Well, really and truly, I never did wear heavy clothes. I did have a parka,
mm-hmm.
and the parka was given to me. The traveling nurse, Mildred Keaton, had brought the parka down to Shishmaref from Kotzebue. It had belonged to an Eskimo that had died, and it was a sweet little thing, a bait of ground squirrels, and so, and she says, we're not going to put that in the casket with him. So she brought it, and that was the only parka I ever owned, mm-hmm. as far as the fur parka is concerned. And then I always wore shoes,
mm-hmm.
and then I had mukluks made, but they almost like what we wear nowadays, galoshes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I had a zipper in the front of it, and it came up to my knees, and all I did was just wear my shoe in it,
mm-hmm.
stick my shoe in just like I could in a big galosh.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that you had to have was a hood. And we had everybody, natives and everybody, wear cover parkas.
Mm-hmm.
And then even the fur or the skin or your coat just doesn't get soiled. You wear a cover parka, and then the cover parka goes into the washing machine or into the
mm-hmm.
to be washed. And it's made out of white denim. And usually it has, and it has a pocket in the front, a big pocket, so you can put all kinds of things in it, in your pocket, and you don't carry things in your hands. And then it has, the important thing is the hood and the fur that goes around the face. My cover parka had polar bear skin on it, polar bear rough for it.
Did you have a polar bear rug by your bed, too?
No, but I had a black bear rug in my home.
Oh, you had a black bear rug.
I had a black bear mm-hmm. rug that came from the Kobuk River area.
Mm-hmm.
I said I'd never live again without a bear rug in my house. But
down in Florida, you probably don't have one.
I don't need a bear rug anymore.
You appreciate it.
Yes. Well, I appreciate belonging to the WLS group. Even though I was not in a military organization of the government, I was with the Alaska Native Service Schools, sometimes called the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and it was within the Department of Interior. And although during the war, I was not in a typical war zone. I still was in, I always felt that we were in dangerous areas because we had no way of knowing what the Japanese people were going to do or what they intended to do. And I do know that the government schools out in the Aleutians and down in the southeastern Alaska were in in what we considered in war zones. I didn't tell about Mr. Ito, who was a Japanese man who lived in Kotzebue. He had a little shack, and so far as I know, I don't know if he was married to this Eskimo girl or whether she just lived with him. Anyway, when Pearl Harbor came, then the U.S. Marshal took him to out to Nome, and then he was sent to a concentration camp down in the United States, lower states. And I remember that Mr. Stenson and the U.S. Commissioner, and then it must have been the U.S. Marshal, had to go to Mr. Ito's house, and they searched his house. And at that time, they were sure that the Japanese people who were up in Alaska, in all of these different little villages, had some connection with Japan. And they didn't know what they'd find, but my husband said that the only thing that he had in his cabin was just an ordinary radio, nothing special. And he had just an ordinary gun, such as all people in Alaska have. So that, but he was never returned, as far as I know, he never came back to Kotzebue.
Is there anything more, Pauline?
I think that's it.
You think that's mm-hmm. it? Okay.
I think that's it.
Well, thank you very, very much. We have enjoyed this recording of your experiences in Alaska.